Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Immediately after the International Court of Justice's ruling on January 26th that Israel is plausibly committing acts of genocide in Gaza, Israel baselessly accused a handful of employees of the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, of participating in the October 7th operation, using alleged confessions that were likely obtained under torture of Palestinian detainees. Nevertheless, as our audience knows, the United States pulled its funding of UNRWA, prompting more than 16 countries to do the same. Slowly, some of those countries and UN member organizations, including Canada, Sweden, the European Union, and this week, Australia, have restored some of that funding. But the United States, in a bipartisan effort, continues to refuse to refund the agency that provides a humanitarian lifeline to Palestinians, not just in Gaza, but refugees in the occupied West Bank, Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon. Joining us to talk about this is Lex Tackenberg. Lex is a senior advisor with the Arab Renaissance for Democracy and Development and a lecturer at the Institute of International Humanitarian Affairs at Fordham University. For decades, Lex worked at the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, as the first chief of the ethics office, and he held other positions at the agency as well. Lex Tackenberg, it's a pleasure to have you with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Great being with you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you so much. You worked for decades at the agency and held a position, as I mentioned, of chief of ethics. Let's start by having you talk about the ethics involved in the agency's handling of these accusations. UNRWA fired five of their employees who were accused of being involved in the October 7th attacks. Can you talk about how you might have handled this?
Well, like all other UN system organization, UNRWA has a setup for dealing with both raising awareness of the ethical and legal standard, the standards of conduct required of personnel, as well as how to respond when there are concerns about violations of those standards. This includes a Department of Internal Oversight Services with an investigation division, with an evaluation division, with an audit and inspection department, and also, and this is a separate sort of standalone function, there is an ethics office, and there is also an ombuds office to deal with different aspects of grievances and ethical concerns. So I've been setting up and heading the UNRWA ethics office starting in late 2009, when an instruction had been issued that all different UN organizations coming under the authority of the General Assembly and Secretary General of the UN were required to set up an ethics function. The ethics function is primarily dealing sort of with preventing ethical breaches. So during my tenure, I was heavily involved in training and also providing guidance to individual staff on sort of the standard of conduct, including the humanitarian principles in particular also the principle of neutrality that is so critical for UNRWA's work and is under such close scrutiny in UNRWA's case. So one example, for example, was the development of a very comprehensive ethics online course on social media and neutrality to train all UNRWA personnel from the Commissioner General to even junior staff, in both international staff and Palestinian staff, in English and Arabic, about sort of the requirements that neutrality, the principle of neutrality implied, and also how to apply it in a social media context, what it entails for social media, what it entails for management of agency's installation, what it entails for employees' sort of political engagement or non-engagement, and for the neutrality of sort of the operations neutrality of vehicles and warehousing and so forth. So that was more the role of the ethics office. In terms, you know, the allegations of breaches of the standards of conduct, whether it relates to corruption, whether it relates to personal misconduct, sexual abuse, or whether it relates to neutrality breaches, and such as the one that were alleged by Israel following the ICJ ruling, they would normally go through the Department of Internal Oversight Services, and in particular to its investigation division. Now, in the case of these most recent allegations, because of the gravity of the matter, because of the fact that it immediately triggered a significant number of donors to suspend funding, UNRWA requested the Secretariat, and in particular the Office of Internal Oversight Services, to take over that investigation, to have sort of further arm's lengths between the agency and the investigation and these serious allegations. And so that is what happened. As we know, OIOS did open an investigation. It sent its investigators down to Amman to sort of look at the allegations as they had been shared with UNRWA's Commissioner General. And then OIOS invited Israel to share further evidence, because Israel had shared the allegations, but not the evidence on which the allegations were based. And my understanding is that until this moment, and in spite of repeated reminders, Israel has not been forthcoming in sharing that information. And that was one of the triggers that has also prompted a number of donor countries to realize that their suspension had been premature, and have prompted them to resume funding. In addition to the ones you mentioned, I just got word that also Iceland has today resumed its funding.
Thanks for that. These countries, Sweden, Iceland, now Australia, Canada, they've kind of slowly started this refunding, but the U.S.'s decision to defund UNRWA, which was, the first domino of that domino effect, had the Democrats and Republicans have been working hand in hand together to keep starving Palestinians in Gaza by not just defunding UNRWA, but providing cover for Israel's ongoing blockade. They're not allowing, they're not demanding that Israel open the crossings to let these thousands of aid trucks in. What do you make of the U.S.'s role in all of this as it pertains to UNRWA?
Well, it is in a number of ways sort of surprising and quite shocking. But there has been a history of extreme scrutiny by the U.S. Congress of the American, of the State Department support to UNRWA. So in that sense, it is not so surprising. There have been a number of reviews by the Government Accountability Office, the Congress's independent oversight body, into use of American funding by UNRWA, and that has time and again resulted in glowing evaluations that UNRWA is doing everything in its power to make sure that funding is appropriately used and no American contributions or other donor contributions for that matter are inappropriately directed to potentially to terrorist or terrorist activity. So it's in that sense, it is quite shocking. Today, Haaretz contained quite a prominent report raising a detailed story by an Israeli social media watchdog, I think fake report, that had revealed that immediately after the ICJ ruling, a series of a coordinated media influencing, digital media influencing operation had been targeted exclusively on sort of the to amplify the allegations against UNRWA vis-a-vis members of Congress and the Senate, and especially younger members of Congress, and this entailed hundreds and hundreds of fake accounts and bots and other sort of fake personas that were automatically responding and reacting with tweets by a large number of younger members of Congress, especially from the Democratic Party. So there has been a sustained attempt at sort of sowing mayhem amongst key influencers in the Congress to sort of sustain this defunding and the scope of it was quite dramatically exposed by Haaretz today. What we see, I mean, I left UNRWA 4 years ago after having been 3 decades with the organization in a wide range of positions. So I've seen many sort of Israeli-led attacks on the agency, and I also want to recall that it was Israel itself immediately, even during the Six-Day War, that requested UNRWA to continue its operations. I mean, Israel realized that if it would not ask UNRWA to do so, then it would have to, as an occupying power, take responsibility for those services, for those basic services itself. So it was Israel that asked UNRWA to continue. There have been, nevertheless, you know, since already the late 1960s and early 1970s, frequent attacks on the agency. But never at such an existential level. One of the problems that we have that I have experienced and many UNRWA colleagues have experienced, that you know these allegations initially sort of sound very serious if you don't know the background and the context and the pattern of which they have been the influencing, the media influencing campaign of which they are part. And so there is a constant turnover in members of parliaments of donor countries, and constantly there is a need to re-educate new members of Congress, new parliamentarians in different countries who sort of jump on some of those issues, especially those from more sort of right-wing, from a more right-wing signature. And I think that's part of it, of what is at play at the moment in the U.S. context as well. So it's very saddening. I understand this week or the coming week will be the expropriation bill, and one of the biggest concerns is language that would sort of permanently prevent UNRWA from receiving U.S. funding. I mean, I hope, really, really sincerely hope that this can be prevented. I mean, as I mentioned, UNRWA is an instrument that Israel itself welcomed and in many ways continue to welcome, although what has characterized, I mean, earlier attacks on UNRWA were clearly targeted towards diverting attention away from certain unfavorable publicity that UNRWA was sort of expecting. And that was clearly, I think, also the intention with respect to the sort of the bombshell on the 26th of January, coinciding with the ICJ ruling. But what we now see is the effect of the extreme right-wing coalition that thinks, well, UNRWA is a manifestation of the international community's permanent responsibility for the unresolved question of Palestine, including the refugee issue. And if we do away with UNRWA, you know, that suits our Zionist agenda. So I think it has sort of got overboard, and I even believe that Netanyahu is, who normally would sort of, if things were going too far vis-a-vis UNRWA, would sort of, you know, say, okay, now it's enough, and we need UNRWA, otherwise we have to take over this responsibility ourselves. And at the moment, it's sort of spinning out of control, and the same seems to happen in the United States.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about that. You were talking about the decades of efforts by Israel to dismantle UNRWA, even though, as you said, during the 1967 war, it was happy not to have the financial burden of, you know, that Israel is obliged to have in terms of its responsibility towards the occupied people as an occupying power. What do you think is at the heart of this effort to wipe UNRWA out or shift responsibilities? We now see some talk by Israeli leaders saying that UNRWA should be dissolved and the UN High Commissioner for Refugees should be the administrative agency for Palestinians. Why are they so intent of getting rid of UNRWA specifically?
Well, I mentioned there has been this pattern of criticism for almost since 67, but it's only recently and with the current Israeli government that it is really at the level of sort of trying to erase UNRWA or preventing UNRWA from continuing to operate, at least in Gaza and the West Bank, but ideally also in the rest of the areas where it works. Until recently, I feel the criticism on UNRWA was to as an instrument of sort of criticizing the UN, part of Israel's frustration with the broader UN, and then UNRWA sort of Israel quite rapidly discovered after 67 that UNRWA was sort of I call it the weak underbelly of the UN system, with 99% of its employees being Palestinian recruited, and therefore part and part of the unresolved situation. An organization that is very operational and that operates in a very volatile environment, so easy to sort of criticize, including for sort of neutrality breaches, anti-Semitism. The first thing that Israel discovered after 67 was sort of the textbook issue. Israel itself, after 67, was responsible for the education system for non-refugee Palestinian children in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. So it discovered that the schools were using Egyptian and Jordanian textbooks, and as they typically do, textbooks, including the Israeli textbooks, reflect sort of the state of affairs and the state of peace or lack thereof between a country issuing the textbook and its neighbors. So there was objectionable content in those textbooks, and rather than sort of taking that up with Egypt and with Jordan, it would criticize UNRWA for using those textbooks, and then there was a whole scandal. UNESCO had to be involved. There was a whole censorship committee set up, and each and every textbook had to be censored, essentially by the Israelis before it could be used in the schools. And that process, essentially, that sort of scrutiny of textbooks is continuing until the present moment, when the Palestinian Authority was established. It started issuing textbooks. Even these came under scrutiny, and then eventually unrest, you know, as part of its response and also as part of the scrutiny that came from the US and the Government Accountability Office, set up a curriculum framework and set up its own review of textbooks, in a way its own sort of censorship. It could not technically censor the textbooks because they were issued by the sovereign host countries in which it operated, so it had to respect them in that sense, but it looked at the content, and if there was objectionable content, UNRWA would issue enrichment materials and a teacher guide to instruct its teachers to, you know, not use specific pages and teach alternative content. And that again has been praised by many educational professionals that UNRISE is having such a thorough arrangement in place, and UNRWA extended it not just to content objectionable on the basis of neutrality, but also on sort of gender stereotyping and other inappropriate content not sort of in line with sort of UN values. So that's just one example of criticism that started very early on, but that never triggered. It was always a measure to keep UNRWA and the UN on its toes, but it was never sort of threatened for UNRWA to sort of stop operations. I mentioned social media after the 2014 war was the first war that really played out on social media, and at that time a number of pro-Israeli monitoring groups sort of scrutinized the use by UNRWA's local personnel of social media account, in particular Facebook. And then there were those staff that had very low privacy settings, and they were occasionally caught by posting content that was sort of seen as glorifying armed resistance or could be interpreted as being anti-Semitic. So that again put UNRWA in a corner and set up this effort that I mentioned earlier to develop a very rigid, very solid social media training, both online and in person. So that gives you a sort of a flavor of sort of the kind of attacks that UNRWA received. What we're currently witnessing, I mean, and occasionally in those debates, people from both sides, both Palestinians and more radical Zionist groups were saying, you know, let's close UNRWA down and let UNHCR take it over. Palestinians sometimes thought that UNHCR would be more vocal in advocating for refugee rights, that UNRWA was not so explicit on protection as UNHCR. And for Zionist groups, UNHCR, they mistakenly believe that UNHCR is focusing more on resettlement of refugees in certain countries, which is a misinterpretation, because UNHCR focuses on the three main durable solutions, which is, when possible, return, voluntary repatriation. If that is not possible, local integration in countries of asylum, in host countries, and if also that is not possible, resettlement in certain countries, and that is not different from UNHCR is not different from what UNRWA or what has been sort of urged by the General Assembly with respect to Palestinian refugees originally in Resolution 194 on sort of the urging that the refugees could return to their original homes. So mistaken belief about what UNRWA, what UNHCR could and could not do. Also a mistaken perception that it was also argued that UNRWA registered sort of the subsequent generations. We're now in the fifth generation of Palestinian refugees, that UNRWA registered the subsequent generations, and UNHCR is not doing that. That's also incorrect. UNHCR also, as guided by the sort of the principle of unity of the family, is giving the same legal status and therefore also registers descendants of the original refugees. However, with respect to UNHCR's caseload, the refugeehood generally doesn't last that long. you know, doesn't typically continue until the fifth generation. But there are exceptions. I mean, the Afghani refugee crisis is also already at its third or fourth generation. So, and there UNHCR acts exactly in the same way as UNRWA does. So a lot of misperceptions. Now, after 7 October, when really the mainstream, when the extremist Zionist agenda that until 15 months ago, with the onset of the current Israeli government, was sort of on the fringes, when that had rapidly become mainstream, and in particular after 7 October, you know, if there were still reservations about Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and so forth, their thinking became mainstream after 7 October. So in that context, and I mentioned earlier, UNRWA is a manifestation, and the continued existence of UNRWA is a manifestation of the unresolved permanent international responsibility for the question of Palestine. When the UN started engaging on the Palestinian question, recommended the partition of Palestine in of historic Palestine in two states, the self-determination or the realization of the state of Israel was achieved, of the Jewish state was achieved, and the Palestinian state was never materialized, and that has resulted in an permanent responsibility by the international community towards the Palestinian people of doing so, and UNRWA is the most tangible manifestation of that obligation. So, you know, rather than dealing with the underlying problem or the underlying situation, sort of focusing on the symbols of that responsibility, of that unresolved refugeehood, seems to be a strategy that the Israeli mainstream has now embraced, and that's why the recent attacks on UNRWA have gone much further than the previous one during the previous decades that I mentioned.
Yeah. Lex Tachenberg, after so many years of underfunding and now defunding UNRWA, how close do you believe the agency is to total collapse?
Well, UNRWA has been a valuable instrument of the international community for indeed exercising some of that responsibility that I just referred to. I also want to recall that it was the Americans, the U.S. government, that was behind the creation of UNRWA, because they saw, as chair of the Conciliation Commission for Palestine that was set up after the assassination of Count Bernadotte, that refugee return was not that likely to happen, and they were starting to look for alternatives, in particular through sort of the second best durable solution, local integration, and they needed an agency to facilitate that, and that became UNRWA. That's the works in UNRWA's name, large-scale public works schemes, actually models on the Tennessee Valley Authority in the U.S. So that's about UNRWA's origins. As for whether UNRWA is close to collapse, it's very clear that Israel is making things very, very difficult. I was earlier today in a media interview commenting that I believe the attacks on UNRWA, especially in Gaza, but you know, to as an extension thereof, also in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem, can be seen as an integral element of Israel's genocide towards the Palestinians in Gaza. I mean, UNRWA represents a huge, you can say, social protection infrastructure, with its schools, its health centers, its social work system, its psychosocial support, its microfinance, its infrastructure work, and all the related people and support structures. So it's one element of making the continued survival of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip impossible. So I think that is, and indeed it is very much to be seen. I don't think that UNRWA in Gaza will be back to business as usual once there is a permanent ceasefire. I think too much has been destroyed. Too many other actors have also entered the scene, which I think is important. So I believe the UNRWA operation in Gaza needs to be redesigned in light of the realities and the context in which reconstruction is going to happen. Is it going to happen, you know, in all of the Gaza Strip? What are we going to witness? So it's too early. In terms of UNRWA as an organization, First, it is the General Assembly that created UNRWA in a majority resolution of the General Assembly. And it's also the General Assembly that is the only body that can formally and legally dismantle the agency. And I don't think there is any chance of that happening. UNRWA remains too important also in the other four areas where it operates. I think, yeah, it's very critical to see what will happen in the US, and I'm very worried about that. But I hope also the US will realize, you know, what an important instrument UNRWA remains at the disposal of the international community. I mean, it's not an organization that came falling out of the air. It was a program created by the General Assembly, by the international community to exercise some of its responsibility. So I hope sort of also their reason will prevail. We have seen after the Trump attack on UNRWA in early 2018 that other donors stepped up the plate, Gulf countries, Germany dramatically increased its contribution. So I believe that somehow UNRWA is too important to let go down. There may be reasons for indeed a change of some of the modus operandi. I mean, UNRWA has always been involved in this direct service delivery, directly operating a parallel school system, a parallel healthcare system. If Gaza needs to be rebuilt as a society, it could well be that, you know, there is one Palestinian education system and health system in the Gaza Strip that you know, where UNRWA's expertise and manpower is integrated, but which does not necessarily need to be operated by UNRWA. I mean, it is a bit of an old-fashioned concept and not repeated by UNHCR and other humanitarian agencies to sort of, you know, direct implement these programs. What I would like to see is that UNRWA is addressing the protection vacuum, and in particular the durable solutions vacuum that was left by the demise or the disappearance of the UN Conciliation Commission for Palestine, which was responsible, amongst other things, for the right of return, for the right of restitution, for compensation. I have been advocating for UNRWA to reinterpret its mandate to include the pursuit of durable solutions, not just return and restitution and compensation, but also more forcefully local integration for those refugees where that is an option. I mean, in Lebanon, the state, the legal status and the factual conditions of Palestinians are horrific, and you know, there is much advocacy needed to improve that. And with the economic crisis in Lebanon, there are also there's also leverage by the international community to sort of force Lebanon to change its attitude. There are also Palestinians who do seek resettlement in third countries. There were Palestinian refugees from Syria fleeing to Lebanon who saw that UNHCR, you know, was taking vulnerable refugees from Syria, people with disabilities, with chronic diseases, would qualify for resettlement in third countries with UNHCR's help. And because UNRWA interpreted its mandate as excluding durable solutions, and Palestinian refugees are in UNRWA's area of operation are outside UNHCR's mandate, those Palestinians would not qualify for similar treatment. And so I have been advocating, and I hope to see opportunities to realize this, for UNRWA taking a more holistic and comprehensive approach to its protection function, also working to upgrade its registration records, to which it is making already a tremendous effort at the moment. It's one of the unsung highlights of UNRWA's work at the moment. Potentially linking it to the property records that the UNCCP left behind when it ceased operations in 1965. These records are all still available. If those records of UNRWA are linked with the property data that pertaining to the refugees, and then we have a powerful resource to sort of, you know, for future reparations, for future restitution claims, and so forth, that UNRWA could undertake, and potentially the sort of the UNRWA taking a bigger distance vis-a-vis the US and some other member states may create a political space for the agency to embark on that. So yeah, it's too early to see, but you know, there's definitely a direction that I think UNRWA can take in light of the situation that we are witnessing.
Yeah, and just for our audience's clarity, what was the UNCCP, and why was it important to understand in this context?
Yes. When the late 47, the UN General Assembly recommended the partition of historic Palestine into a Jewish state and a Palestinian Arab state, that triggered sort of the I would say the first steps of war. Between then the sort of the Zionist armed forces and Palestinians and that blew up in full war when in May 48 Israel was declared. The UN responded to that war by establishing a post of a mediator for Palestine, Count Bernadotte of Sweden. And he started to sort of, you know, work towards containing the situation, initial steps towards ceasefire. And also, because he was a humanitarian, a lifelong humanitarian, he was the vice president of the Swedish Red Cross. He had sort of in the Second World War operated and even been involved in rescuing Jews. So he witnessed sort of ethnic cleansing happening. He knew what the legal ramifications of that were. So he made a recommendation 3 months into his mandate or 4 months into his mandate for the refugees to be allowed to return. One day after he made that recommendation, he was assassinated by Jewish extremists, the Stern Gang. So in the aftermath of his assassination, in the following months between September and December 48, the General Assembly considered, you know, how to go about this mandate and his role and his recommendation, and that resulted after extensive negotiations. I mean, I think 194 is one of the most deliberated UN resolutions in the organization's history. his
that's one the, portion. The resolution that is the resolution mandates that, the right of return for Palestinian refugees, yeah.
And establishes the Conciliation Commission for Palestine. So the General Assembly decided to replace a one-person mandate by a commission comprised of three states, not individuals. The US as the chair, Turkey and France as the other two members, to essentially pursue the mandate of the mediator. There was an interim mediator after Ben-Ali's death, who Ralph Bunche, who negotiated the ceasefires. But the Conciliation Commission started to look for a more longer-term solution, and that included return of the refugees, as well as other aspects recommended by the General Assembly in the resolution creating the UNCCP. And so it was the Americans who in the first half of 2019 took the lead in trying to convince Ben-Gurion to take refugees back. And Ben-Gurion, the first president of Israel, essentially said, this is not going to happen. We're still in the process of consolidating our new state, and return is not in order. So then the Americans in the summer of 49 started looking for alternatives. If return is not going to happen, what do we do? And then it was actually the American ambassador in Cairo who thought it would be a good idea to bring Gordon Klupp, the president of the Tennessee Valley Authority, on a feasibility study to see whether the TVA miracle could be replicated in the Near East. And that happened in September, October 49. And then that resulted then in a recommendation to create an agency to take on that role. At the same time, the humanitarian agencies that had provided initial relief to the refugees, the ICRC, the League of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, and the Quakers, the American Friends Service Committee in Gaza, they announced in the autumn of 49 that they were not able to continue their relief operation beyond the spring of 1950. And so the UNCCP also had to provide for an alternative relief mechanism. And that is how UNRWA was then sort of shaped, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, Works, the large-scale public works agency for Palestinian refugees in the Near East, or for Palestinian refugees in the Near East. And initially, and I mean, there was quite a bit of cynicism amongst host countries and also refugee representatives about this mandate of UNRWA. They had met with Gordon Klupp and politely offered him tea and listened to him, and he had interpreted that as his overtures were welcome, but in reality they were much more cynical. And then especially when the initial draft resolution was floated by the Americans, the initial draft resolution to establish UNRWA was floated by the Americans, there was no reference to 194, to refugees, to anything about sort of temporary arrangements, so pending return. So the host countries or the Arab states were very sort of critical, and then the Americans sort of amended the language and said, the new resolution is without jeopardy to the right of return. But in actual fact, by adopting the resolution establishing UNRWA, the General Assembly in 12 months' time had shifted from an approach to solutions based on return and voluntary repatriation to an approach to solutions based on local integration in the host countries. So indeed, the refugees had reason to be skeptical. And when I teach UNRWA, I sometimes talk about, UNRWA is born in original sin, as a undermining the right of return, which remains a legal imperative contrary to local integration and third country resettlement, which is subject to sovereign decisions of third states, return is a requirement under international law in view of the illegality of the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. That and again, this is what Count Bernadotte knew, and this is why he said refugees should be allowed to return, because he had seen in the Second World War, and it had just been the Nuremberg trials that forced displacement and forced transfer in wartime was a war crime, and therefore triggering both individual criminal responsibility and state responsibility, and by means of reparations, and reparations for situations of forced displacement is sort of return, restitution, compensation where the properties were damaged, and so forth.
Yeah. Finally, Lex Tackenberg, as someone who worked in UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, for decades, and now seeing what your colleagues who are still at the agency are dealing with, what are you most concerned about right now when we look at the situation on the ground in Gaza through this just horrific genocide, while the US and other Western countries supported by Jordan are doing these very theatrical aid drops that are not addressing the needs of the 2.3 million people in Gaza who are facing catastrophic starvation, which is a policy that Israel has engineered. What are you most concerned about right now as you watch all of this happen?
Well, I'm obviously very concerned for the safety and security and well-being of both my former colleagues in Gaza, many of whom I known for having worked there, for having worked with the agency for decades, including a decade in Gaza. So I'm very, very concerned and heartbroken for the 160 or so UNRWA colleagues who were killed since the 7th of October. So I'm really, really worried about their well-being, their safety, their ability to also, about 2,000 or 3,000 of them have on a daily basis continued to sort of provide emergency relief to the entire Gaza population in those in shelters, those seeking medical care, and many having been involved in the emergency relief and food aid operation. So I'm very concerned, and by extension, of course, to the Palestinian refugees. It's one thing to sort of observe a genocide as an academic, as a human being, sort of from a distance, but having lived there for a decade and still having friends beyond also UNRWA colleagues from the period that I lived and worked there, is really heartbreaking. So my heart goes out, and my sympathies goes out to the people in the Gaza Strip. And then I'm hoping that, as I mentioned earlier, that some sort of sanity will eventually prevail, and we will result in a ceasefire. I hope the ongoing negotiations in Doha will bear fruit and will at least put a stop to it, for the time being. And then, of course, I think we will face an even more massive shock once Western and other journalists are more freely able to access all corners of the Gaza Strip and see the scope of the destruction and. I've also been thinking a lot as an academic, in my role as senior advisor for ARDD, on the longer term implications of 7 October, and this is daunting. I mean, this is the biggest sort of shakeup with respect to the question of Palestine, but I would say even to the entire Middle East since 1948, and a lot of ideas and thoughts that are sort of milling through my mind, and I'm trying to find time to put some of them on paper, and I'm very concerned about the longer term implications. I also see tremendous opportunities there. I mean, the biggest takeaway from 7 October is that the status quo is not sustainable, and we need to. I spoke about designing a new future for Gaza. I mean, we need to design a whole new way forward for Israel, for Palestine, for the broader Middle East, and I would say the genocide in Gaza and the international community's reaction to thereto. I mean, and sort of the fact that we see sort of the West against the rest, or rather the Western elite against the rest of the world, is something that will also have, you know, enormous repercussions in the years and I would say decades to come. So we're in a profound period, and I'm acutely aware of that, and trying to sort of in a modest way contribute to that process of reflections.
Mm. Well, I appreciate that so much, and I know our audience will as well. Lex Tackenberg, you're a senior advisor with the Arab Renaissance for Democracy and Development. You held various positions at UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, for decades. Thank you so much for spending time with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast. We'd love to have you back on sometime soon.
It was a pleasure.